Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our talk show for the morning. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour today, we will be trying to do a little background about where things stand now with the worldwide HIV and AIDS pandemic. And our guest for the program is Dr. Thomas Quinn. He is professor of medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. And in his research and clinical interest, he's particularly interested in HIV and sexually transmitted disease. He's here visiting in the community, and we'll be talking tonight at Carl's 7th Annual HIV Conference at the Carl Forum. That's tonight between 6 and 8, and I'm told that it is open to the public, and anyone who is interested in attending, I think, should feel welcome to stop by if you're interested in asking questions or just getting a sense of the basic place that we are now worldwide with HIV. I think that's the kind of thing that I'll be talking about. But of course, that's also what we want to try to do here this morning on the show. And for people who are listening, if you have questions, they are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of people who call is that they are brief as possible, and just so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many people as possible. But anyone's welcome to call. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be in the town.
I'd just like to, I guess, start out by talking some numbers. And maybe to the most basic number, first of all, would be worldwide, how many people have been infected with HIV? How many people have AIDS?
So actually, the numbers are estimates. There, right. No one really knows the exact number. What we believe is, since the discovery of the HIV virus, and this is now its 20th anniversary, because it was discovered in 1984, and as we move into 2004, it'd be 20 years, and we had discovered the clinical condition of AIDS 4 years before that. And if we start with a cumulative number of individuals worldwide who have become infected with HIV in this 20-year period, the estimate's about 75 million people. It's probably now the greatest epidemic of our times. And it continues to march relentlessly throughout the world. Africa has borne the scourge of the epidemic. Right now, there's about 28 to 29 million people living with HIV. And every year, 2 to 3 million people die on that continent alone from untreated HIV. And that has resulted in a huge response. Right now, worldwide, there's 42 million people living with HIV, and about 25 million deaths from this epidemic.
You talked about the fact that, of course, this is an estimate. I think we have reason to believe that there are probably significant numbers of people who have been infected, who are HIV positive, but who don't know it. Is there any way to put a number on that?
Yeah, actually, there is. They estimate that in Africa, somewhere between 80 to 90% of people still carrying the virus don't even know they have it. So they unknowingly will transmit it to other people. That's why the epidemic's out of control there. The same is true in Asia, where it's a newer epidemic. For the last 5 to 10 years, it's been marching through India and China and Indonesia and Cambodia and many other neighboring countries. So in the developing world, the estimate is 85% of people do not even know they're infected. Now, what about the United States? The estimates from CDC is that approximately one-third of people infected with HIV in this country don't even know they have the virus. Mm-hmm. It's because when you get infected with HIV, you can be asymptomatic for 5 to 7, 8 years. And unless you get tested, either when you go to donate blood or if you go into voluntary testing because you might have recognized you have a high-risk behavior that puts you at risk, you're not going to know until you have full-blown AIDS. And that's too late. You really need to be identified earlier so that you can access treatment and get care. And we have great treatment for HIV-infected people, especially in this country, Europe, and the developed world. What we're trying to do is move that great treatment into the developing world where the need is even greater. Mm-hmm. But if an individual's HIV infected, gets properly counseled and gets on the right treatment, they don't have to develop AIDS. They may have HIV for their life, but they may not need to progress to AIDS with the right treatment regimens.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, early on, of course, as people will recall, the first place the disease was identified was in gay men.
Right.
And so people figured that it must have something to do with sexual behavior. And indeed it does, but not exclusively with the kind of sexual practices that gay men engage in. What we came to understand was that the virus was in very high concentrations in certain body fluids. It's in semen, but it's also in blood. So that means if you engage in some kind of sexual behavior that involves exchange of body fluids, or if you engage in some kind of behavior that will lead to some kind of blood-to-blood contact, like injection drug use, mm-hmm. or it could be some kind of medical procedure, if you have poor infection control, then that's what's going to happen. So it is possible in sexual contact between people of the same gender or people of different genders, can be homosexual, can be heterosexual, but also IV drug use, and then a variety of other things that people might be doing that involve contact with blood.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you look at all of that, and we understand real well now how it is that it's transmitted, what now are the primary avenues of transmission, particularly in the developing world?
In the developing world, it is, and in the developed world, we can easily say sexual transmission is the leading mode of spread of HIV. Probably 80% of all those infections we just talked about, the 70 million or thereabouts, has probably been transmitted from one person to another through sexual contact. And again, as you said, it's either homosexual or heterosexual transmission. In the developing world, the vast majority of infections have occurred heterosexually. The male-to-female ratio is 1-to-1. So there, for every male infected, there's a female infected, vice versa, in the developing world, because heterosexual transmission is so common. Misuse of needles, even for medicinal purposes, that are unsterilized, has spread HIV. In China, a terrible tragedy had occurred, was recognized in Henan province just 2 years ago, where they were not sterilizing the blood transfusion equipment. And over 100,000 people got infected with HIV because of non-sterilization of blood transfusion equipment. Had nothing to do with heroin or drug addicts or anything like that. So in the developing world, where you might worry about reuse of medicinal purpose, you know, needles or transfusion equipment, that's still a major way of spreading HIV. But in this country, and I always like to bring it back because people mm-hmm. aren't in Africa and they want to know what's happening in their community and so forth, we still have the same modes of transmission that were recognized back in the early 80s, except for two. Two are pretty much almost non-existent now, and that's it's almost impossible to get infected through blood transfusion now because of the way we screen the blood so rigorously for this virus. So that was a problem before, you know, 1985. After that, the numbers of cases who have acquired HIV through blood transfusion is almost zero. The second mode of transmission is from mother to infant transmission, and that has almost been eradicated in this country and in Europe because every pregnant woman should be screened for HIV. Even if she's been monogamous with the same partner all along, they still should be screened, because if they're found to be infected with HIV, they can be treated, prolong their life for 20, 30 years longer, but they'll also, through treatment, prevent the baby from getting infected. And if you look at the numbers in the U.S., we have almost very few cases of infants who have acquired HIV from their mother. Now, that's different in the developing world because, once again, those people don't have access to treatment. Mm. So that leaves us with really two modes of transmission left in this country. And that is sexual transmission. We're seeing more heterosexual transmission than we ever did in the past, but we still are seeing this resurgence of HIV spread among gay men again. This is very problematic, very troublesome, because this was the main way, as you said in the beginning of the epidemic, through education of gays about risk reduction, the spread started to decline in gay men. Now, because of we have access to treatment, people are getting a little bit more careless, we're starting to see an upswing. We have epidemics of syphilis, rectal gonorrhea, and now HIV in gay men in most communities across this nation. That is really something that I really want to encourage the gay community to rise to the occasion and start to go back to risk reduction education. The other way we still see a lot of spread is through injecting drug use. Mm-hmm. And that's a national problem. Every community has this. It's particularly bad where I live in Baltimore. And I would say over half of the patients I see with HIV are heroin addicts. And getting them to either stop the drugs is more problematic than I think a lot of people realize. And so we try to go to needle sterilization if they're going to continue to use, get them into methadone clinics, get them counseled and educated, get them treated. So those are the two main remaining modes of transmission, heterosexual and homosexual transmission, and injecting drug use. Yeah.
I should introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in here the last 5 or 10 minutes or so. We're talking with Dr. Thomas Quinn. He's professor of medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. And in his research and in his clinical practice, he's particularly interested in the development of HIV and sexually transmitted disease and of the care of patients who either have HIV or sexually transmitted disease. He's here visiting in Champaign-Urbana. We'll be speaking at the Carl Forum as part of Carl's 7th annual HIV conference tonight from 6 to 8. It is open to the public, so if you're interested, you can attend. Questions here are also welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. What do we know now about how much virus a person must be exposed to in order to become infected?
Well, you just hit upon my life's work of study. This is the area that I've been most active in researching. And we went into Africa to actually study this in heterosexual transmission. And what we find is that an individual who's infected with HIV, we can measure in their blood how much virus is present. And we measure it per milliliter of blood. It's like a teaspoon of blood, how much virus is in that teaspoon. And if the amount of virus is above 1,500 virions per ml of blood, they are infectious. And the higher that level, the more infectious they are. So if a person gets newly infected with HIV, the viral copies in that teaspoon of blood will be over 2 million copies. They are extremely infectious to another individual, and they may feel absolutely fine. They don't even know they've just gotten infected. That's the problem. We believe over half of all transmissions occur in that very early period, probably the first 3 to 6 months of when one person gets infected, they will pass it to another person. And to try and find those people and educate them and get them to do risk reduction is obviously very difficult. And it's why our epidemic continues at the same rate for the last 10 years. It hasn't declined any more than what it was 10 years ago. In fact, in some populations, it's increasing, like the gay men that we just talked about. So we can measure the blood. We can try to assess how infectious a person is. Now, there's complicating factors to this. What kind of sex do they have? Are they using a condom or not? Are they engaging in anal rectal sex, which is highly risky? But vaginal sex will transmit this virus either way if the virus levels are high enough. If a person has herpes and is infected with HIV, they're two to three times more infectious to their partner. Because of the breakdown in the skin and the ulcer, the virus will spread directly from that herpetic ulcer. Now, I bring up herpes because we now know from antibody studies about 30 million Americans have genital herpes, have been exposed or have at least markers of having had genital herpes. Now, not everyone has an ulcer when they're having sex from it. But at any given time, probably 500,000 Americans probably have active herpetic ulcers. And if those people come in contact with an HIV-infected person without practicing safe sex, that virus will get transmitted. So while we say the viral levels are the most predictive of transmission, the factors that enhance transmissibility are sexually transmitted diseases like herpes. Syphilis is another genital ulcer that will enhance transmission. We think gonorrhea and chlamydia also enhance the infectiousness of an individual by increasing the shedding of the virus in the genital secretions, what you had talked about before. Mm-hmm. So once we knew this, then you can go about with biological interventions. That is, treat those sexually transmitted diseases. We have drugs that can suppress herpes and keep people from getting ulcers. We can treat the chlamydia, the gonorrhea. We can treat the syphilis. So we'll decrease infectiousness if we could get those people to come to STD clinics, medical clinics, get them treated. The other is through education. And the education is extremely important in terms of knowledge and how you might be able to protect yourself from getting infected. You know, number one is abstinence. Number two, if you're having sex, then you need to use a condom. Number three is avoiding anal rectal sex. That's very risky. Even oral genital sex seems to enhance some transmission because the virus is in the genital tract. And if you have some bleeding gums or some ulcers in your mouth or canker sore or whatever, maybe the virus will get in. Mm-hmm. So I think people need to know that. Now, the more controversial response to trying to prevent transmission is to treat all the infected people with antiretroviral drugs. That's expensive. And it means getting people into care early, very early. We do believe, though, with treatment, you lower the viral load, you lower that person's infectiousness. Everyone asks me, can you reduce it to zero so I don't have to worry? The answer is no. You cannot reduce it to absolute zero. The virus is still there. We've never been able to cure a person yet. So while I can assure someone that they're less infectious, they're still infectious. Mm-hmm. And they need to practice safe sex if they're having sex.
Let me go back because I just want to underscore two points that you've made, not to belabor the point. One, simply because I think from time to time there has been some people have questioned the effectiveness of condoms as a barrier against the virus, HIV, and I have raised this question, well, now, is it really true, do we know for sure that the HIV virus cannot, assuming that it's using a high-quality condom and you're using it properly, are we sure that it cannot somehow get through the condom?
It cannot get through the condom. You mentioned all the important caveats, though. Did they put it on early before sexual intercourse began? Did they leave the condom on until after, completely after sexual intercourse? Are there no breaks in the condom, et cetera, et cetera? Mm-hmm. So if you do all the caveats, it is protective. Now, you know, a lot of people say, yeah, but come on, you know, pregnancies sometimes occur when people say they were using condoms. The fact is they didn't use the condoms right. Condoms can be very, very effective. There's several studies in the literature, some in the U.S., some in Europe, and now some in Africa, in which they took couples in which one was positive and the other one was negative. And so a lot of the listeners might say, well, how did that one person get infected? Well, in the U.S., it could have been a male hemophiliac. And that male hemophiliac got infected before the blood was carefully screened back in the 80s. But that male hemophiliac was married. So they then followed the wives of those men. And for those that said they always used a condom when they had sexual intercourse, none of those wives got infected. For those that said they used the condoms intermittently, some got infected. For those that said they couldn't stand condoms and they didn't want to use them, 15-20% of the wives got infected. The same study with different population was done in Europe. Same result. 100% use of condoms with sexual intercourse was 100% protected. Actually, no one got infected. Mm-hmm. So I honestly believe if they're used right, they do work.
That seems to be a significant issue because, as you say, people have studied it, and particularly in when it comes to control of other sexually transmitted disease or as a contraceptive method, that you do have people who say, well, you know, we used condoms and it didn't work. And then you say to them, okay, now you use the condom, right? They say, oh, yeah. And say, okay, did you have any kind of sexual contact before putting the condom on? If you go right down the line and say to them, okay, now you're telling me you did it just exactly the way we say, you put the condom on from the very beginning, make sure that it fits properly, make sure when the male partner withdraws the condom is still on, all those kind of stuff, then people start saying, well, maybe not really. So if you do it exactly like you're supposed to, then it really is effective both as a method of contraception and as a method of limiting the spread of sexually transmitted disease.
That's exactly right. We did one study once of individuals coming to a clinic and we educated them about using condoms, and then we'd have them come back and we would say, did you use them? And there's this type of, you might call it, a positive reinforcement that they sit there across from the clinician and they know that the clinician is looking for the yes answer. I did use them, sort of like a student would do to a teacher. Yeah, I did my homework, but didn't do all the homework. The same thing's often true between a patient and their doctor relationship. They sort of don't want to be told, well, I told you to use it and you didn't, and so forth. So we then did some biological testing on the people who said, oh, yes, I always used it. And we found out they were, in fact, getting infected with chlamydia and gonorrhea. Fortunately, no HIV in this population. So we went back to those who got infected versus those who didn't. And we found out with a very detailed, careful questionnaire administered by a peer rather than a clinician, that they actually owned up that they didn't use them all the time correctly. Mm-hmm. So there are these factors that, have put a sort of a cast of doubt on use of condoms as a means for protection. And so people have moved back towards abstinence. And now abstinence, we might as well put that on for the listeners, 100% protective, if it's truly abstinence. Now, remember, I did say oral genital sex can sometimes transmit that. So you have to be careful when we say abstinence. What does that really mean? But there's people who are sexually active, and for them to go from their sexual activity to an abstinent life is I'll just say the word problematic. It's part of basic nature needs of many human beings, and people have alcohol and they lose their inhibitions, and while they might have intended to be abstinent, they then remain abstinent. If that happens, you've got to have some means of recourse to protect yourself. Have the condom ready. What a lot of women would like is empowerment of themselves. Always asking the man to have that condom is, it relies on her dependence on him. So there is a major effort to looking at female condoms, if you want to call them that, to using microbicides that might work. A lot of money is being invested federally to investigate these. There's a big study underway of diaphragm use with microbicides, protecting the cervix from getting exposed to the virus and so forth. But we don't have the answers for those women yet. But those studies are underway, and we hope that at some point we will be able to have a means from which women will be totally empowered to protect themselves from their sex partner of getting infected. And I must say, in the developing world, I said this in the beginning, there are as many women infected as there are men. This is not a gay disease. This is a heterosexual disease in the developing world. In the U.S. now, if you look at all the new HIV infections, 40% are among women. So women are getting it. They are not safe or protected in any way from getting HIV.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Dr. Thomas Quinn. He's professor of medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore. And he's here visiting. He's going to speak at the Carl Forum tonight as part of Carl's 7th annual HIV conference tonight from 6 to 8. It is open to the public. If you're interested in attending, you certainly may. Questions here, too, are also possible, as always. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. One other thing that I also want to go back to regards heterosexual transmission, and I think the reason I want to ask the question is because it seemed to me that at some point, at least maybe some years ago, and perhaps people still have this idea, I think that they understand certainly that the HIV, that the virus is present in semen. And then if they think about it, they probably would also understand that in vaginal secretions, that it would be there too. Mm-hmm. But that I think that people have this idea that may or may not be the case, that it is more likely that an infected man will pass the virus to his female partner than it is an infected woman pass the virus on to her male partner. Mm-hmm. Partner, for some basic reasons, it has to do with the mechanics of sex. Is that indeed the case? That is, that women are at greater risk of becoming infected in heterosexual sex than are men?
In this country, the answer is yes. And now you might want to say, why'd you cage that answer with just this country? And there's some, all the heterosexual studies are what we call partner studies between a man and a woman in which one is infected and so forth. In almost every scenario, when you look at the odds ratios, it's more risky male to female than female to male. So we went into Africa where, as I mentioned, half of the women are infected. When you look at all infected people, half are women, half are men, and you're saying, well, how can that be if it's more infectious going male to female? And so we went into couples, and we found that among partnerships that have been going on for more than a year in which there's been sexual activity, on average, it's about twice a week among these couples. So that might be 100 sexual episodes in a year, something like that. And we followed them for over 4 years, counseled them, gave them condoms, did all the appropriate means to try and prevent transmission. But nevertheless, we found a 20% transmission rate over the year. And it was equal, male to female, female to male. And we said, what's going on here? We didn't think it would go that way. And we found out that female-to-male transmission, if the male is circumcised, is not very efficient. If the man is uncircumcised, then it's equal transmission, male-to-female, female-to-male. So a number of studies were then done to say, is this true across Africa? There are some tribal rites in which circumcision is performed. Muslims, of course, circumcise throughout Africa. And many other groups do not. And we found out those men that are getting circumcised have much lower rates of infection than do men who are uncircumcised. Hope I said that right.
Yeah.
So we went back to the U.S. studies, and we found out that in almost all of those couple studies, the men were circumcised. So female-to-male transmission was less efficient than male-to-female when the male happened to be circumcised. So this was done in Europe then. They got interested, and most European men are uncircumcised unless they're Jewish. And it turns out, lo and behold, male to female, female to male transmission is equal when the male happens to be uncircumcised. So it looks like, biologically, a circumcised man is less susceptible to this virus. I'm not saying he's totally, not at risk. He will still get infected if given enough exposures, or has herpes or a sexually transmitted disease. But circumcised men seem to be less infectious. So this has turned out to be, almost fascinating as to biologically why is that. And turns out an uncircumcised man, not to get too much into dermatology here, but it turns out the epithelium of the foreskin is almost identical to vaginal epithelium. And the virus seems to be able to cross that barrier. When the foreskin's been removed in circumcision, virus that skin then becomes cornified, stratified, cornified, becomes much more resistant to the virus unless there's an ulcer. Then it can get in. And that's why I think herpes and syphilis enhance that transmissibility to men, because it's broken down that normal barrier to the virus. So there are three big trials underway in Africa right now of circumcising men and seeing if it's going to protect them over time. We have to do something to slow this epidemic. We don't have a vaccine ready to go. The drugs that we have are expensive. We're trying to get them over there, and maybe we can talk about that in the second half. Mm-hmm. But until then, we're dependent on behavior change to try and slow this epidemic. And that hasn't worked real well over the last several decades. We've had some positive. Uganda's lowered their infectious rate. Thailand has lowered theirs because of political leadership and education of the people, mm-hmm. right down to every village possible. So we have a lot of work to do, but this is a new means. We've never done this before, going around circumcising men to try and prevent them from getting infected. Now, for the women out there, for every man you can protect from getting infected, that means every female sex partner of that man, you've just protected her. So this is it has been encouraging, and we'll have to await the results of the trial. It should be out in 2 years. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, thousands of African men are getting circumcised.
Well, let's talk about treatment, because that is indeed one of the big things that has changed. We now have medications, collections of medications that we're giving people, combination therapies that have proven very successful in prolonging the life of people who are HIV positive. It's not a cure, but right. what apparently is happening is that we're making it possible for those people to live longer. The downside is that these medicines are very expensive. Mm-hmm. Certainly it is expensive for people in the United States to take them, but it's an even greater issue when we're talking about the developing world. And of course, a number of strategies have been undertaken to try to get these medications to places where the numbers of people with HIV are the largest, where the rate of increase is the largest, where really we are talking about a devastating epidemic. We were trying to do that in a couple of ways, simply by just allocating money, by having the developed countries saying, okay, we'll give you this much money to help fight the disease. And then there's this other issue of, okay, we know we have these medications. What can we do to try and cut down their cost? Can we persuade the drug companies to sell them for less? And then perhaps the most controversial thing is to say, well, we're going to say to hell with patents.
Yeah.
We're just going to, if you're a developing country, you're going to say, well, we're just going to set up our own plant and we're going to make it. And if you don't like it, that's tough. We've got people dying here, and that's what we're going to do. So can we talk about where we are with all of that?
Yeah, there's been an enormous global response to this need for treatment for the impoverished individuals throughout the world. That includes the United States. There are communities that still have difficulty getting access to drugs for their people. But for Africa, let's take that. Right now, there's 3 million people that need to be treated in Africa. They will die within the next 6 months to a year if we don't get treatment to them. The Global Fund for AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria was first developed 2 years ago by Kofi Annan, the Secretary General of the United Nations. The United Nations General Assembly approved this program and has raised several billion dollars for treatment. It's not enough. And the stream going in has not been steady enough. And they'll probably run out of money in a couple of years if it doesn't get maintained. That's what we call a bipartisan or an international response. President Bush and his group of advisors came up about 6 months ago with a different plan. And it's called the President's AIDS Relief Fund for AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. And some of that money, it's $15 billion over 5 years, some of that money will go to the Global Fund. But most of it will go to 14 countries that have been listed as the most hard-hit countries in the world for AIDS. And the Secretary of Health, Tommy Thompson, was just in Africa with all of Ambassador Tobias, who's in charge of this program. We hope that by the end of January, if the omnibus bill gets approved finally and so forth. Mm-hmm. The political nature of AIDS is incredible. But now, keeping on the medicinal side, if these funds start to flow to these needed countries, well, actually, we'll start to see movement of treatment to these individuals. Now, you raised the issue, trade drug versus generic drug, and how do you address that? The pharmaceutical companies have reduced their prices for Africa. Because there's no profit there, so they might as well give it at cost because they can't afford it at the higher prices, so it doesn't even get used. So they did work with UNAIDS, which is sort of the international coordinating body of this, to lower their prices to cost. So when the generic companies start to say, hey, heck with this, we're going to make our own drugs and heck with patents, mm-hmm. Turns out the price of those drugs aren't too much lower than what the pharmaceutical companies are making their trade drugs at cost available in that country. With this new money, the WTO, and again, here comes the politics, and other groups have basically said, hey, if the country has a national emergency with this epidemic, they should be able to get drug wherever they can get it. And if it means going to generic makers, fine. They will not be penalized in the trade wars that we have going on internationally. This is a national medical emergency for that country. And they can use whatever drug they can get their hands on. They can work the pricing levels and see what works best. The person who's been most active in bargaining for this was a surprise to me, at least. But past presidents usually get pretty dedicated to humanitarian efforts. We see that with President Carter. The President Clinton has sort of dedicated his post-presidency to getting lower-priced drugs to the people who need them most. And he just returned from South Africa, from the Caribbean, and has been very proactive in lowering prices of generics and of the trade drugs so that people can get them. Right now in Africa, we can probably treat an HIV-infected person with triple drugs, which is sort of the standard now in the U.S., for about $150 to $300 a year. The comparable price in the United States is about $15,000 a year. So we really have gotten those prices down in these impoverished countries. Even still, if you think about $150, $300, you might say, oh, wow, that's great. That's really low. But for people in Africa, that is their total annual salary to pay for those drugs. So they would have to give away their entire annual salary. So how do they feed their family? How do they take care of other problems? So even though we've gotten prices down, we need the governments and private industry to step forward to help with the donations, to help provide these drugs. Finally, after I don't know how many years, South Africa has finally stepped to the plate and said, for those people who can't afford it, we will make the drugs available. Other countries are doing the same. We do that in the U.S. If you cannot afford treatment out of your private insurance, or if you're uninsured or whatever, we have a safety net, and people can access treatment. It's a bureaucracy. We have to go through a lot of forms, but people can be treated. So I think 2 years from now, we're going to see a huge difference. Right now, I'm just frustrated that I don't have the drugs to treat my African patients the way I do for my Baltimore patients.
Yeah. Well, certainly the pharmaceutical industry has come in lately for a lot of criticism because people say, you know, one of the things that really contributes significantly to the high cost of healthcare is the high cost of prescription medications. Yeah. And we have more and more people who are taking more and more medications. Some people have really targeted the industry and said that they are making unreasonable profits. And something should be done about it. And, you know, here's one of these cases where obviously the pharmaceutical companies have tried to address this issue, if for no other reason than public relations. How well do you think that they have done, and are they doing everything that they can do? Can one say is that there's still unreasonable sort of profiteering going on here, taking advantage of people who have this devastating disease? Or would you say, well, no, in fact, on balance, they're not doing too bad in trying to make those medications available, to make it possible for people who need them to get them?
I'm going to answer it a little indirectly. I'm going to tell you one of the issues that patients have to face, and that is they don't take their drugs all the time. They're going to develop resistance. We call it an adherence or patient compliance to the drugs. It's true with any antibiotic, and it's true with HIV. HIV mutates constantly, and if you stop taking your medication, you miss a couple doses, the virus says, okay, and it starts to evolve to a resistant form. The pharmaceutical companies have actually responded to that need. There are now 20 drugs on the market for treatment of HIV, and more coming. There's at least 20 in the pipeline. Now, who pays for the research for the development of those new drugs? The generic companies do not. Generic companies just basically take what's already been approved and then copy it in their factories and give it at reduced cost. And that's fine when patents run out and so forth. So what the pharmaceutical response has been, we need to make some money on the licensed approved drugs that are out there, take that money and turn it around and put it in R&D and start to come up with new antiretrovirals. Mm-hmm. We often will look at the profit margins and we say, where's that money going? Is it going to shareholders? Well, people who own stock in the pharmaceutical companies will probably say, yeah, I do want my stock to go up. For people who don't own stock and who say this is privateering and this is taking advantage of poor people, you know, there is a segment of truth to that. But I must say, some companies have been more responsible than others. I'm not going to name names, but some of the companies have really led the way. They've donated money for the people and for institutions that need access to treatment, like in Africa. And they've made their drugs available for free, charged no money. Some of those companies need to be applauded for what they're doing, not chastised for overpricing in other arenas. Some companies make a lot of money off of their cardiac, lipid-lowering drugs. And hopefully, if there is some money made there, that will go to this other niche of the company to help develop treatment for HIV-infected people. We need new drugs constantly. Somehow, we have to depend on the pharmaceutical industry to make those new drugs. they need money to make those drugs. The only way they get it is through some of the profits that they get for charging. I just hope everyone understands the economy of that. Yeah. I would love to see them give more drugs away for free for the people who can't afford them, or to work with governments that will help pay for that as well. So it's an indirect answer, but I hope the listeners get to see both sides of the equation.
We just have a couple minutes left. There's one thing I guess I wanted to touch on real quick at the end, and you talked about the fact that the virus, HIV, is constantly mutating. That's what makes it very difficult to deal with. It's very tricky. What do you think the possibility is that at some point we might see a vaccine for HIV?
Well, I said there were 20 drugs that are licensed and can be used. There's at least 20 vaccines that are being tested. I don't know what's taking so long. This has been the biggest frustration for all the scientists in the field. The virus just keeps evolving. It keeps changing. And a lot of money, a lot of effort has gone into trying to come up with a good, effective vaccine. We've just completed internationally two trials, what we call phase three trials. This is for efficacy, for protectiveness. They failed. They did not work. Over 15,000 people got vaccinated, and it didn't work at all. Very discouraging. Do we give up hope? Do we stay optimistic? Answers, yes. We have to stay hopeful that, you know, our technology keeps moving. Maybe at some point our technology will be a step ahead of the virus. We did it with drugs. We can now treat. We can't cure, but we can treat people and keep the virus in check. I think we'll be able to come up with a vaccine at some point. I don't want to even put a timetable on it. Mm-hmm. If people think there's going to be a vaccine in 5 years, forget it. It's going to take that long to just test the ones in the pipeline right now. So we're still talking 2010 before there's a safe and effective vaccine out there. That mm-hmm. sounds like a long time from now.
Well, we have come to the end of the time. I want to, again, tell people who are interested that our guest, Dr. Thomas Quinn, will be speaking tonight at the Carl Forum. This is part of Carl's 7th Annual HIV Conference. That's tonight from 6 to 8, and it is open to the public. So if people would like to hear more, they can certainly do that. Tom Quinn is a professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for inviting me. Thanks for listening. All right.